Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters. This is Background Briefing. And joining us now is Robert Service, a British historian, academic and author who has written extensively on the history of Soviet Russia, particularly the era from the October Revolution to Stalin's death. He is currently a professor of Russian history at the University of Oxford and a fellow of St. Anthony's College, Oxford. His expertise on Russia is broad. He served as an expert witness in the recent trials between Boris Berezovsky and Roman Abramovich in London's Commercial Court and has written about the recent demonstrations in Russia in the New York Times. His latest book just out is Spies and Commissars, Bolshevik Russia and the West, the early years of the Russian Revolution. Welcome to Background Briefing, Robert Service.
It's great to be with you.
And it's extraordinary how, in many ways, I guess it's a sad fact that in many ways, the era that you've written about, of the early Russian Revolution, lives on in a way. You have a KGB officer running Russia, turning back the clock, exhibiting the worst aspects of xenophobia, paranoia, and authoritarianism. And today, of course, Putin presided over the victory parade in Moscow after having basically cracked heads a few days ago on Sunday and on Monday, on the day of his inauguration. Does it depress you as much as it depresses me?
Well, it does, yeah. It really does. I don't think the Russians have deserved the succession that they've had in the past 100 years. I mean, you know, Nicholas II was bad enough. Lenin was, if anything, even worse. Was one of the worst despots in human history, and dictatorship lasted through to the end of the Soviet era, almost. And now they've got something that's so authoritarian and so brutally oppressive politically that one only has to despair of anything better coming out of Russia. Except, you know, people are getting onto the streets now. Unfortunately, they're having their heads broken, but they're standing up to this this appalling administration that they've got.
But what explains, though, how long it has taken for the Western press and not that Western leaders have absolutely spoken the truth about it? There's a very interesting book out now by Marcia Gessen, Man Without a Face, and she's a very courageous woman for telling the truth. And I just, you know, as much as in your book, Robert Service, Spies and Commissars, there is that continuing kind of apologies for Lenin, suggesting that the Red Terror was forced on him by foreign intervention, etc. And people have gone through hoops to suggest that he was misunderstood and a good guy and Stalin was the one who stole the revolution, etc. And the same mechanism has been in play here with Putin, the denial about who he really is.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right. And I think the answer to why this cycle of misunderstanding recurs is that many people in the West try to sort of think the best of very authoritarian rulers because they simply can't believe that people can be so oppressive. But the other thing that goes on, I think, is that some groups and individuals in the West have an interest in coming to an accommodation with, in the case of Lenin, the early revolutionary administration, and in the case of Putin, with the business elite, the criminal business elite that is presently running the country, but is offering good deals for Western business who are prepared to risk their finance over there.
Well, I suppose the one piece of leverage that exists over Putin that the West has is that Putin is parking all of his money in the West, right?
Yes. Well, the British judicial system is presently acting as a sort of arbitrator on a lot of the commercial disputes that in the 1990s were settled in Russia itself by guns. At least the business environment over there is beginning to turn to the law, but it's not turning to Russian law to the extent that it's turning to British law. And this is one very, very small step in which I was involved in a little bit of before Christmas, which is to the good, but it's a very, very sad reflection on the state of affairs since the fall of communism.
Again, I'm speaking with British historian Robert Service, an author of extensive history on Soviet Russia and from the October Revolution to Stalin's death. He's currently professor of Russian history at the University of Oxford and a fellow at St. Anthony College, Oxford, and the author of the new book, Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. Just to touch on briefly before we get to the book, what's the beef between Berezovsky and Roman Abramovich? I mean, I know Berezovsky was involved as a protector of the fellow that was killed by polonium. And again, Marcia Gessam's book points out the obvious, that it was Putin. I mean, it seemed to be clear from day one, but everybody's been equivocating about it. What's the beef between these two billionaires?
Well, these two billionaires are arguing about who promised what to whom. Because I was involved in this case as an expert witness, and because the verdict has not yet been declared, it won't be declared until I'm not allowed actually to make much further comment of it for fear of destabilizing what the proceedings are all about. And they were very, very lengthy proceedings, with both Berezovsky and Abramovich themselves appearing in court most days. It was a most extraordinary experience. Hardly imaginable.
Well, it's extraordinary that you have this theater inside and outside of Russia that you just pointed out, Robert Service, that you, in order to get some semblance of justice, now it's the British courts as opposed to the Russian courts, which, of course, one of the first things that Putin did after taking over the press, he took over the judiciary and put the head of UKOS in jail and basically expropriated all the assets. And he essentially regulates the kleptocracy, all of which is based in oil and gas. And you've got all these sort of exiles, and you've got the guys still back there that are in favor. Can you characterize the dance that goes on in KGB Incorporated between the boss, as he's called, and the oligarchs?
Yeah, well, he certainly relies a lot on ex-KGB men. He relies on a system that is an amalgam of intelligence agencies and criminal gangs and people who are willing to sort of act as intermediaries between those two sides of British public life and the elected representatives. But the elected representatives, of course, themselves are as corrupt as anyone else. The people who really lose out of this are the Russians themselves. And one of the positive things about what's been happening in the last few months is that it's educated people, people who go onto the internet, who don't rely on Russian TV for their sources of information, who are taking to the streets. They're very, very brave. It really hasn't happened since the fall of communism, since 1991. It's the one single positive thing that's happened in the last few years. Certainly Putin is not a good thing for Russia. He hasn't diversified and modernized the economy. And without that, Russia is doomed in the years ahead. I think Putin knows this, but he's not done anything about it.
Well, I guess he's just riding on the oil and gas gravy train, and as long as it's up around $100 a barrel, he can keep the show going, right? But if we wean ourselves off oil and oil goes down, then the whole place could collapse.
Well, indeed. Of course, Saudi Arabia would collapse as well. And if you build an economy on your natural resources, really you're mercy of the world market in those natural resources. I mean, there have been so many Russian briefing papers about this. The administration knows what the problem is, but the administration gets very, very rich from the status quo, and it's not really minded to do very much about it.
Well, let's turn to Robert Service again, British historian, academic and author, who's written extensively on the history of Soviet Russia, particularly the era from the October Revolution to Stalin's death. He's currently a professor of Russian history at the University of Oxford, and his latest book is Spies and Commissars, Bolshevik Russia and the West, the Early Years of the Russian Revolution. So we'd started out earlier about saying how benighted the Russian people have been for so long, living under despots, and there was that sort of window of hope there when Yeltsin came in, and Putin has pretty much closed that window. Going back to the area that you're writing about, it's a story, I guess, just not to belabor the Putin analogy, but the thread here is about spies as well as commissars, right? There's always been intrigue. It's almost in the DNA, right?
It absolutely has. And in the early period of the Russian Revolution, going back to 1917, the bulk of the spies were Western rather than communist Russian, because Russia was in a dreadful state and had a civil war, and its intelligence agencies and counterintelligence agencies had their hands full holding on to Russia. The West, for the first year or so, did have a very effective set of espionage agencies, and they were very, very important as information gatherers. Because the diplomats were really not in a position to do the normal job that they had done before 1917, simply because there was simply no recognition of the communist regime, because it was regarded as an illegitimate administration.
Well, clearly, after World War I, the U.S. and the British sent their expeditionary forces, but it seems to have been a kind of, you know, tragicomedy of errors, in the sense that Lenin and the revolutionaries had these delusions of world communism, of taking over the world, and the West were sort of ambivalent or inept in terms of their determination to strangle the revolution in the cradle.
Yeah, you're right. Of course, we know now what happened next. We know that the Soviet administration confirmed itself in power and lasted 70 years, but that wasn't known at the time. And so some Western leaders imagined that perhaps if they did nothing, if they perhaps just blockaded the new Soviet Russia politically and economically, that the problem would go away and that the communists would be overthrown. Some of them thought the best thing to do was to accommodate themselves to Soviet Russia and to have trading relations. And among those countries, Britain was foremost in making a deal with Lenin's Russia. And it did so at the most grievous point in early Soviet Russian history, because it was at that precise moment when the peasants and the workers and the soldiers and the sailors were revolting against Soviet power. And it was at that very moment that British Prime Minister David Lloyd George signed the Anglo-Soviet Trade Treaty, which gave a huge amount of relief to Lenin's government.
After World War II, Attlee gave Stalin the jet engine. There's a history here of, you know, some people would call it appeasement, others would consider it, you know, détente? I mean,
I think it goes back further than that. I mean, the Germans traded technology through the 20s and early 30s, then Hitler came to power and all that stopped. And then the Americans took over in the 1930s under Roosevelt. The Ford Motor Company sold its technology, sent over its engineers to help with Stalin's industrialization. I mean, this sort of thing started to cease after the Second World War, when the so-called COCOM agreements started to kick in, and the Americans started to put a block on technological transfer. And that's one of the reasons that the USSR collapsed in the end. It really didn't have access to the advanced technology unless it could thieve it, unless it could conduct industrial espionage that it needed for its own modernization.
So in that era that you're talking about, Robert Service, of course, here in Los Angeles, we have Occidental Petroleum and Armand Hammer.
Right.
And I remember talking with the former head of the National Security Agency, and he told me that he had the unenviable task of briefing Ronald Reagan, who was a friend of Armand Hammer, saying that, well, you know, your friend is actually a Soviet agent.
Yeah. Well, he certainly was an agent of influence, even at the weakest definition of agent. He was a reliable conduit for the Soviets to carry messages and do commercial deals that perhaps wouldn't otherwise have happened. Yeah, he did a lot of damage, Armand Hammer.
What do you mean he did a lot of damage?
Well, he was one of the agents of influence that the Soviets used in the West to promote a view of the Soviet Union that was much more benign than the reality. And under president after president, he did the same thing on behalf of the USSR.
So he would have been what the KGB used to refer to as a useful idiot.
I'm not sure he was an idiot.
No, he wasn't an idiot.
he built a whole career out of cunningly playing one side against another and making a vast fortune in the process.
Indeed. I'm speaking with Robert Service, a British historian, academic, and author who's written extensively on the history of Soviet Russia, particularly the era of the October Revolution to Stalin's death. His latest book just out is Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. So is there anything in terms of future projects that you're thinking of? I mean, most of our discussion has sort of tied the past to the present, and regrettably, it's all too easy to do. Repression lives on, and disappointment continues, and the Russians have been so shortchanged over the decades in terms of what they deserve and what they end up with in terms of governance. I take it, though, that you still have a lot of affection and faith in the Russian people, as indeed I do.
Yes, I do. I think it's going to be difficult for them, but they've got a great culture. They've got a mass of educated people who know what's wrong with the country. If only they had the political opportunities to do something about it, things would be so much better. It's going to take many decades ahead, I think, before things change, simply because the Putin administration is so ruthless and so fortunate in having a very high price on the world market for oil and gas that it's hard to see how it would be undermined in the short term. I'm doing a new project, actually, on the end of the Cold War. It's rather like a bookend to the first book, and to try to see how it was that communism ended in the late 1980s, and what were the factors on both sides in the USSR and in America that affected a series of conciliatory moves between the two countries. I think what happened after the Cold War, though, was there was too much conciliation. There was too much indulgence shown to Boris Yeltsin and then to Vladimir Putin. We're only now beginning to get a second breath.
Well, absolutely. Anything that Yeltsin wanted, it was anything but the communists, and they were never going to come back. It was an absurd policy that Clinton followed, and it was a totally blind policy that George W. Bush followed, you know, saying, looking into his eyes and saw his soul. I mean, surely there's, as a historian, the analogies between Stalin and Putin are pretty clear. They were both small-time thugs, very, very minor individuals, no talent, no vision, you know, but they've literally going to end up ruling about the same period. I mean, I think Putin's got 12 years under his belt, and he's just setting himself up for another 12.
Yeah, it's pretty grim. I think the popular discontent will grow. The one great lesson in Russian history is that when trouble happens, the rulers are always the first to be surprised. You know, if you think of how the last Tsar was overthrown, a sudden outburst of popular emotion, when people take to the streets and the forces of law and order go over to the side of the people, it could happen again.
Well, that's probably why Putin drove to his inauguration through empty streets.
Yes.
He's afraid of the people. Well,
afraid of the people, indeed, yeah.
Well, I thank you for joining us here today, Robert Service.
Well, it's been a real pleasure.
Again,
thanks for having me.
Thank you. Again, I've been speaking with Robert Service, a British historian, academic, and author. He has written extensively on the history of Soviet Russia, particularly the era from the October Revolution to Stalin's death. He's currently professor of Russian history at the University of Oxford and a fellow at St. Anthony's College, Oxford. His expertise on Russia is broad. He served as an expert witness in the recent trial between Boris Berezovsky and Roman Abramovich in London's Commercial Court and has written about the recent demonstrations in Russia in the New York Times. His latest book just out is Spies and Commissars, The Early Years of the Russian Revolution. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters, and I'll be back again, and assistant producer Maria Trutanich, and I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.